This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Drones from Ukraine strike deep inside Russia, ratcheting up the stakes of the war and sending a message to Western allies.
This is, I think, Kyiv with its own declaration of independence saying, we will do what we think we need to do.
Also today, southern Syria has not posed much of a political challenge to President Bashar al-Assad. Now people in one city are turning on him.
Attacking government buildings, burning pictures of Assad himself.
Plus, Qatar might have the attention of the world right now, but women soccer players in Canada want their moment too.
Right now, the opportunities they have versus the opportunities the boys have, they're not even comparable. The boys get a lot of the resources, and the girls get what's left.
So some Canadian women are starting their own professional league. I'm Marco Werman. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being here today. This morning, for the second straight day, missiles from Ukrainian drones struck inside Russia. They hit an oil facility near an airfield in Kursk, some 80 miles from Ukraine's border. Yesterday, drones launched from Ukrainian territory were aimed at two military bases, hundreds of miles inside Russia. We wanted to know how these strikes change the stakes and balance of power in the war. So we reached out to Russia scholar Mark Galeotti. His new book is called Putin's Wars from Chechnya to Ukraine. Mark, three attacks on or near Russian airfields in 24 hours, one very far from Ukraine's front lines. Is it a significant uptick in the war? What does it all mean?
It is a significant uptick. Look, we shouldn't overplay it. I mean, actually, this is probably the Ukrainians making use of old Soviet-era kit that they had that dates back to the 1970s, but still clearly has its uses. And I think more than anything else, this is a political gesture. It's not actually going to seriously change the balance of power on the battlefield. But what it does is it demonstrates, first of all, to Moscow that Kyiv is willing to reach out and no longer essentially consider itself to be a sitting target. But it's also, I think, a sign to the West. There have been all kinds of attempts of late to essentially try and rein in Ukraine, even while supporting the Ukrainians, a sense that, well, we don't want the Ukrainians to win too much too quickly because that might create an escalation. This is, I think, Kyiv with its own declaration of independence saying, we will do what we think we need to do.
And yet Kyiv is not directly owning up to these attacks. Why not?
I think to a large extent, they enjoy playing these kind of information games to actually keep the Russians guessing. For example, although it does seem almost certain that all or most of these attacks were carried out by these 1970s vintage aircraft, the so-called Strij Tupolev-141, they also suggested they had developed some new hyper-capable long-range attack drone, which may exist or it may not exist. But the point is, from their point of view, they want Moscow to be uncertain exactly what's going on, uncertain as to whether it's because the West has just given the Ukrainians some new capability or quite what is going on.
What's been the reaction from the Kremlin and among ordinary Russians who might now feel vulnerable?
For the Kremlin, actually, there is a sense that it is perversely possibly to their advantage. In that, you know, for some time, Putin, or more to the point, his propagandists have been saying, look, this is actually not just simply a battle with Ukraine. It's a battle with Ukraine and NATO. And that actually it's an existential struggle for Russia's own survival. And I think what they are going to do is to try and find a sweet spot between the admitted embarrassment of saying that the Ukrainians are able to penetrate deep, deep into Russian airspace, despite all the massive air defenses that are meant to be in place. But at the same time, spin it round to say, you see, we told you so, that everyone is at risk, and that's why we're having to fight and win this war.
From Ukraine's point of view, what is the risk and potential gain from these strikes?
The risk is clearly that it triggers another round of escalation. But the point is that the Russians escalate on an almost whimsical basis as is. They've just launched another major barrage of cruise missiles. I think, frankly, from the Ukrainians' point of view, they don't really have that much to lose at this stage. And the games, first of all, it's an element of keeping Ukrainians heartened. I mean, this is a very, very hard war for the Ukrainians, especially those not just who are in the front line, but the ones who are suffering with regular power cuts in the middle of a very cold winter and such like. So I think it is important to show to ordinary Ukrainians that, in fact, this is not a war that is being lost, quite the opposite, that actually Ukraine has the initiative. And also politically, it's a sign to the West that Ukraine is continuing to fight, and to put it in very crass terms, that the West is getting return on its investment, that all those billions of euros, dollars and pounds that are being sent to Ukraine are actually having an impact.
Yeah, how are Ukraine's Western allies reacting to these attacks inside Russia?
On the one hand, it is impressive that Ukraine is able to expand the war this way. And it is encouraging because it shows that the Ukrainians are not getting bogged down. Because the worst thing from the West's point of view is this just becomes a lengthy and incredibly expensive stalemate. But on the other hand, there seem to be no signs that, for example, Kyiv had warned its allies what it was planning on doing. There is a constant concern these days about actually, you know, how little, frankly, control the West has over Ukraine, how little of an opportunity it gets to basically, you know, weigh in on what Ukraine's strategy may be. So, you know, at the moment, I think, again, it's just this wary appreciation.
Is that a good thing, that kind of distance the West has from Ukraine right now?
It's inevitable. The point is, we shouldn't pretend that there is unity within the West. There are some countries, particularly those closer, like Poland and the Baltic states, who are very, very alarmed about Russia and in a way see this as a way of undermining Russia. There are others who think this is purely about helping Ukraine regain its sovereignty and don't want to see the war expanded at all. Since we are not willing to have a proper, honest and open discussion in the West about what we want from this war, we have to accept that it's going to be the Ukrainians who will be taking the initiative. And maybe when there are peace talks someday, and there's no sign of them yet, that will be the point where we can actually weigh in and say, well, this is what we would like to see. But for now, it's the Ukrainians who are doing the fighting and dying, and all we can really do is support them.
Mark, as for possible Russian retaliation, and shifting gears a bit here, how Putin sees these attacks? I mean, it's a tricky question really about Putin's frame of mind and how he's thinking about escalation. Does he have a choice, though, other than pushing the tempo of the war higher?
To be honest, I don't think he has any choice. It was interesting that the same time as these attacks were taking place, Putin was on a very performative drive across the Crimean Bridge, which had previously been hit by a Ukrainian truck bombing. So in some ways, this was meant to be his day to catch the headlines, and instead the Ukrainians snatched it. But I think, you know, really, look, the Russians every now and then, they can pulse some new attack, but they are beginning to run short of long-range missiles and drones. And more to the point, their strategy is now just to try and outlast Ukraine and the West. They're digging in. They're clearly hoping that by signaling that they're willing to take this to whatever lengths necessary for however long it takes, that that will dishearten the West from continuing to support. So I think from Putin's point of view, he has to balance the desire for revenge with what this is actually going to cost him in the long term. And so we tend to have, you know, a day or so's flurry of attacks. But then once again, it sort of beds down. The Russians are really trying to dig in for the long haul.
Russia scholar Mark Galeotti, his new book is Putin's Wars from Chechnya to Ukraine. He joined us from Washington. Mark, thanks very much.
A pleasure.
Attention may be on the Men's World Cup of Soccer. Today, though, cast your eyes over to big news for women's soccer. Two of Canada's star players from last year's Olympic gold medal winning team just announced that they are helping to start up a new women's professional league. Eight teams across Canada with the hope of coaxing Canadian women who play abroad back home. From Toronto, reporter Anita Elash has more.
Caroline Sega will have the opportunity to win it for Sweden.
Canadians were glued to their screens back in 2020 as the Olympic gold medal game in women's soccer went into overtime. Canada missed three of their first five shots, and it looked like Sweden would win. Then Canadian midfielder Julia Grosso took her turn.
Julia Grosso from Vancouver to win it for Canada! Canada came! Canada conquered! Canada gold at Tokyo 2020.
It was the Canadian team's first ever Olympic gold medal. Like the announcer, amateur soccer coach Kim Brasser was elated.
That they were able to get right through to the very end and bring back the medal for Canada. It was quite a moment for the country.
Brasser runs a soccer school for girls in Oakville, Ontario, a wealthy suburb just west of Toronto. She says that since the Olympic gold medal win, more girls than ever want to play. But without a professional women's league, there's been virtually no chance of building a career in Canada.
Now, the opportunities they have versus the opportunities the boys have is not even comparable. The boys get a lot of the resources and the girls get what's left.
Canadian men don't have a professional league, but they do have three teams that play in Major League Soccer. Retired midfielder Diana Matheson is leading the project to establish a women's league. She's got support from Christine Sinclair, the Canadian who holds the world record for the most goals in international play. Matheson told the CBC the league will create new opportunities for Canadians.
We're going to have eight teams to start, four in the East, four in the West. We're looking at having a bit of a designated salary structure to make sure there's at least one Canadian women's national team player per team. On top of that, there's 110 Canadian women plus playing professionally right now, so the target is bring about half of them home.
But a professional league can only help women if it succeeds. The chances of that, says Canadian sports economist Moshe Lander, are...
small. I'll say that a little louder and without the laughing. Small.
Lander says soccer is one of the sports Canadian kids most love to play. But in terms of adult spectators with money to buy tickets, there's just not enough interest to sustain a league. Ticket sales peak leading up to the World Cup and then drop off until the next one. The new league would also have to compete with the National Women's Soccer League south of the border. And Lander says that will be a struggle.
The NWSL already has seniority. It already has top-notch players. It has television deal. It has a financial backing. There's nothing that the Canadians would be able to do to overtake that first mover advantage.
The first two women's professional soccer leagues in the U.S. both failed. Now, after 10 years, the NWSL is thriving. Lindsay Gibbs is a sports journalist and co-host of the feminist sports podcast, Burn It All Down.
We are seeing valuations of teams skyrocket. We're seeing new teams come into the league every single year. And we're seeing players earn more than they've ever earned before.
Gibbs says that if women's professional leagues have struggled, it's because there's a double standard. Men's leagues get years to become profitable. Women's leagues are expected to be an overnight success.
So I think the biggest thing that women's sports needs is patience from those with money, a willingness to invest and to see the big picture and give them time to flourish.
Brasser says she believes that with patience, a Canadian professional league will unearth the talent it will need to survive. Even just four teams would open up spots for 100 women.
There's 100 more girls that are staying in the game and 100 more girls that are being role models to lots of other young girls playing. So it would just create more opportunity and talent would stay here at home.
Diana Matheson, the founder of the new league, says she's in it for the long haul. She expects the first teams will be up and running in 2025. For The World, I'm Anita Elash in Toronto.
Later this hour, still on the soccer tip, the thrilling improbable finish of the World Cup match between Morocco and Spain. And coming up, a beloved bookstore in London has closed its doors. Readers of Arab authors and their works are saying goodbye to Alsaki Books. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Officials in the Democratic Republic of Congo say that nearly 300 people were killed last week. It reportedly happened when a rebel group attacked a village in the eastern part of the DRC. Officials are blaming the armed group known as M23, which the Congolese government says is backed by the government in neighboring Rwanda. This news comes as dozens of Congolese rebel groups are meeting in Nairobi, Kenya, for talks to bring an end to the violence. From Nairobi, The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi reports.
Officials from the Democratic Republic of Congo say the killings took place last week in a village called Kisheshe. Julian Paluku is the DRC's Minister of Industry. Around 270 civilians were killed, Paluku said, and many of them died inside a church, he added. Officials are pointing their fingers at M23, a well-armed rebel group that has recently resurfaced in eastern Congo, fighting against the government and killing civilians. Patrick Muyaya is a government spokesperson in the DRC. The United Nations has said M23 behaves like a full army, he said, and that their weapons have to come from somewhere. DRC officials are blaming Rwanda, but the Rwandan government has denied supporting M23, though a UN report has suggested otherwise. M23 says it's not responsible for this recent massacre, but the group was noticeably absent at peace talks being held in Nairobi over the past week. Professor Serge Chibangunzenza is the special envoy for DRC's president.
Those who committed that massacre are not here, and that's the reason why they're not part of the political process, right? Because in the beginning, they've been violating the resolutions that were taken.
Including a ceasefire resolution and agreement to stop attacking civilians. He said M23 hasn't lived up to those pledges.
That shows really that we are facing terrorist and violent groups that need to be dealt with by the region.
By the region, he means the East African community. It's recently deployed troops to the eastern DRC to help stabilize the region. Mwamini Mbambu works with a local NGO in North Kivu. She tells me about the situation there. We face a lot of problems because of the fighting between armed groups, she says, including sexual violence. These recent peace talks have brought people like her together with rebel groups and officials to discuss a pathway towards peace. There are hundreds of rebel groups operating in eastern DRC. Many of their leaders say they are protecting their own communities. George Balungu is a spokesperson for the Mai Mai Kirikicho, one of the armed groups in North Kivu. We took up arms not to fight with our government, he tells me, but to defend ourselves from illegal and foreign groups like M23. Today, representatives at the peace talks agreed to maintain a ceasefire, release child soldiers, and enable humanitarian access. Ask Balungu if now is the time for his group to give up its weapons, too. No, we won't disarm until foreign armed groups have left. We have to protect our people, he says. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
Sad news for book lovers in London. Alsaki Books, Europe's largest Middle Eastern bookseller, just shut its doors for good. It's considered a literary institution, not only in London, but across Europe. Alsaki's owners blamed Brexit and the rising prices of Arabic books for its closure. It's leaving a pretty big hole in the heart of London's Arab and Middle Eastern community. Elias Jachan joins us from London. He's a journalist and editor of the anthology This Arab is Queer, which was released this year by Alsaki's publishing house. Elias, people everywhere can relate to the feeling of walking into a favorite bookstore. It's just really homey. Describe what the Alsaki bookstore is like.
Yeah, look, it's one of those typical independent bookshops, but it has its own feel because it's a very niche bookshop. It's the bookshop that specializes in the Arabic language and books that have been translated from Arabic into English, and also books published in English by Arab authors. So when you walk in, it's like it's got a beautiful, beautiful facade at the front on a really nice area of London. When you walk in, it's like on one half, it's all Arabic language books, and on the other side, it's all English language books. I think when you go into the bookshop, the fact that there's big ceilings and it feels very open kind of feeds into that, is the openness about it. So yeah, I think that's really great.
And as we know, bookstores aren't just places to buy books. They can also be places where you find often the same people and community. Was that the case for Alsaki as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's amazing how everyone, so many people in the diaspora living in the UK know of Alsaki. And so many people, when they visit London, they make a point to visit Alsaki to buy books from them. Their legacy and their reputation just precedes them. So I think it does definitely create a community in that sense, that it just brings people in all the time.
So what has been the meaning of Alsaki for the various communities that have turned to it for its books?
I mean, like I said, I think the way Alsaki described it themselves is, it's perfect. It provides a home away from home. It provides access to books that you wouldn't get at mainstream bookshops, and specifically books that are in the Arabic language for people who speak Arabic. And also it crosses over to people who were born and raised in the diaspora and might not necessarily know how to speak or read Arabic fluently, and provide books by Arab authors published in English. And I think it's just, I think it's really, really important to have ourselves, our community represented and feel seen in the literary scene, and to have our stories published in books in this way, and for us to tell our stories our own way.
Alsaki published the book that you edited, this anthology called This Arab is Queer. How did that come about?
It was just an idea that came about while I was working during the lockdowns, during the COVID pandemic. And when Saki came on board to take the book, I was really, really excited because I had already been to their shop a few times and had bought a few books from them already. And also when Saki came on board, I knew that they had a track record of publishing really good anthologies and doing really well with them. So that just made it even better for me to go to them. And these anthologies that Saki has done before, like This Arab is Queer, are examples of books and stories that have never been done before. So it's like the first of its kind.
Yeah. What do you think that represents, that Alsaki would take on something like This Arab is Queer, something that had never been tried?
I think it just represents how forward-thinking they are and how progressive the publishing house is, and the fact that they're inclusive of everybody in the Arab community. So I think that's super, super important. And it goes against the narrative where people are always saying the Arab community is homophobic, the Arab community is transphobic, blah, blah, blah. So I think having Saki books representing us in this way and giving us a platform to tell our stories, it just goes against that narrative and really smashes that stereotype to pieces.
Elias, where do you think Arabic readers will go now to find some of their favorite titles?
I would like to think that another bookshop that's dedicated to Arabic language books would open up somewhere in London, because ordering stuff from Amazon is just so ridiculously expensive. Like one of the other roles that Alsaki Bookshop played, it just made the accessibility to this Arabic language book so much easier for people.
Elias Jachan is a social media editor for the New Arab website and the editor of a new book called This Arab is Queer, an anthology of LGBTQ+ Arab writers published by the just-shuttered Alsaki Bookstore in London. Elias joined us from London. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
More stories from around the globe coming your way just ahead. You're listening to The World. Morocco versus Spain in soccer today at the World Cup. Former colony versus colonizer. In Barcelona, you could cut the tension with a knife. This is historic, says this young man born in Morocco but raised in Spain. Who won, who celebrated, and who cried? Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Indonesians have been waiting more than 70 years for an update to the country's colonial-era criminal code. Yesterday, they got it, but it's not what many were hoping for. The new laws passed by Indonesia's parliament ban sex outside of marriage, penalizes those who insult the president and vice president, and outlaw certain political views. To break all this down, I'm joined by Jeremy Menchik, author of Islam and Democracy in Indonesia, Tolerance Without Liberalism. He's an associate professor in the Pardi School of Global Studies at Boston University. Jeremy, let's explore this ban on sex outside of marriage first off. What would that look like in practice?
In practice, Marco, it's going to look like selective enforcement. Bans on sex outside of marriage, as well as bans against homosexuality, bans on, let's say, people from different ethnic groups or different religious groups, or bans on any kind of behavior that we think of as really occupying the private sphere, are notoriously difficult to enforce. And so in practice, states don't enforce them, especially states with relatively low capacity to investigate private behavior like Indonesia. So it's only going to be enforced in a very selective way and probably in sort of a high profile way. And that's if we actually see it enforced. You have to remember that the law as passed by Indonesia's House of Representatives is only going to go into effect in 3 years' time. 3 years is a long time. Between now and then, we're probably going to see a lot of protests and mobilization by civil society, as well as court challenges. So if it goes into effect, when it goes into effect, it's probably going to be enforced very weakly and selectively.
And this is partly why you think this story is not over.
I think this story is not over. We've seen similar efforts by conservative elements within Indonesian civil society, as well as within the states, to try to put into place what we might think of as highly conservative or illiberal laws. they haven't made a lot of progress, but they've made some progress over the past 15 to 20 years. And human rights organizations have been on the defensive for really the past 15 to 20 years. While Indonesia is a democracy, we think of it as a low-quality democracy, similar to Poland, similar to Turkey, and similar to the United States, where there's so many infringements on the rights of minorities, as well as other electoral problems in terms of representation, that we don't think of it as a robust democracy, but rather a low-quality democracy.
And Jeremy, what about the provision in this law on insulting the president and vice president of Indonesia? Is what constitutes an actual insult spelled out in this new law?
So what's problematic about that aspect of the law is that it represents a kind of coalition of conservatism that tells us a lot about what's driving the law, right? So the president, we know, has something of a thin skin, so that's probably why he supports this regulation. Otherwise, there's also conservative groups within the government, including his vice president, Maruf Amin, that have long been calling for conservative regulation of sex outside of marriage.
Conservatives and President Joko Widodo's thin skin, as you put it. I mean, it helps us understand part of what's happening. But beyond that, what's going on in Indonesia that's motivating this law?
Indonesia is like a lot of countries in the developing world where, due to economic globalization, we're seeing increased economic inequality within the country, which is decreasing the middle class's support for democracy. Basically, if you want a strong democracy, particularly if you want a strong liberal democracy, you need a strong middle class. But unfortunately, what you've seen, and this is not just an Indonesian story, it's also very much an American story, is something of the hollowing out of the middle class because of globalization and economic neoliberalism that are weakening the middle class's support for democracy. Because what's the benefit of free speech? What's the benefit of representation if it doesn't lead to, you know, strong educational institutions, strong social welfare programs, functioning schools, picking up of trash? And so people are a little bit tired of some of the extremes and the messiness that sometimes comes with democracy if they don't always see the benefits of it.
Who are the groups in Indonesia opposing this new law? Like, who will keep it on the ropes?
So there's a coalition of at least 40 different civil society organizations that are opposed to this law. Unfortunately, they were caught rather flat-footed. The law was only revealed on Saturday and passed on Tuesday. That then puts these civil society organizations, as well as, you know, a lot of media organizations, that now puts them on the defensive where they're going to have to go to the courts. So this is not a good sign. This is a bad moment for Indonesian democracy. There's no doubt about that. This is a bad moment for civil liberties in Indonesia. There's no doubt about that. But we've seen other moments like this before in Indonesia. And what often happens is that civil society mobilizes, human rights organizations mobilize, and the moderates tend to win out overall. So don't count them out quite yet.
Jeremy Menchik is associate professor in the Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University and the author of Islam and Democracy in Indonesia, Tolerance Without Liberalism. Jeremy, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me, Marco.
A city in southern Syria erupted in anti-government protests this week. What was surprising was the location. Sweda is in government-controlled part of Syria, a part of the country where you don't typically hear about a crowd of angry protesters chanting for the downfall of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. But that is exactly what happened on Sunday. A government building was torched, and at least two people were reportedly killed in clashes with security forces. The World's Shirin Jafari reports on the frustration that led to this outburst of violence.
The news coming out of the city of Sweda is reminiscent of the early days of the uprisings in Syria. Protesters stormed the governor's office building and set it on fire. They climbed up the outside of the building and ripped down the large poster of President Bashar al-Assad. They also stomped their feet on his pictures. this level of public outrage aimed at the Assad government is unprecedented in Sweda, experts say. This city is home to a religious minority called the Druze, and they have mostly stayed out of this decade-long civil war.
I think for the first time now we see demonstrators attacking government buildings, burning pictures of Assad himself.
Ateba Idlibi heads the Syria program at the Atlantic Council. He says there are several reasons why people are protesting in Sweda. The economic situation is one.
We've seen inflation rates that reach 250% in some areas around Syria, especially outside metropolitan centers.
But that's not the only reason why people are frustrated, he says.
We've seen a rise of tensions over military conscription of youth in Sweden, but also the latest episode was the government's corrupt network that was helping distribute and transfer drugs, specifically Captagon, in Sweda province and through Sweda province to Jordan.
Syria's whole economy has faced serious problems in recent years. The war has been devastating, but then came the pandemic, and the country is still under heavy economic sanctions. Add all this together, and it helps begin to explain why the anger is reaching a boiling point. Joel Rayburn is former U.S. Special Envoy for Syria.
The normal people on the street or in the business community can look around and they can see the Shabiha, the militias, and the businesses that are associated with the Assad family driving around in fancy luxury cars. No fuel shortage there, living a high life, going to fancy restaurants at the same time that everyone else is really struggling just to make ends meet.
To get a sense of what it's like in the city of Sweda, I got in touch with an activist called Raya. She only wants to use her first name because she says she's been threatened by supporters of the Syrian government. Raya tells me people in Sweda know all too well the type of brutality the Assad regime can unleash on the population. She says she worries about the situation becoming even more violent. Raya says the government might try to punish people in Sweda by cutting them off from daily necessities like food and fuel. That's a tactic the government has used in the recent past. Raya is active in a campaign called We Want to Live. It's calling for better living conditions for Syrians. In the past, Roya says, when people rose up, they were kicked out of universities or they lost their jobs. But she doesn't see these protests going away. They might calm down for a while, she says. But unless there is meaningful change, things will explode later on. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Tomorrow on The World, we shift our focus to northern Syria and look at the potential for Turkey to launch another ground offensive on its neighbor. Al Jazeera, the media network, is taking its case to the International Criminal Court. They're providing evidence to the ICC in the case of the killing of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. She was shot and killed in the West Bank town of Jenin in May. Al Jazeera says new evidence shows it was a deliberate killing by the Israeli military, a claim Israel has repeatedly denied. Joining me is Al Jazeera's Washington bureau chief, Abdurrahim Fukara. Abdurrahim, how did Al Jazeera come to this decision to formally submit a complaint to the ICC?
The network had made the decision that it was going to wait and see what happens with all the other investigations. Al Jazeera's position now is that we've waited for too long for light to be shed on exactly what happened, for a thorough and independent investigation. That has not happened, and it's time to go to the ICC.
So Jazeera is using evidence from its own investigation and other evidence gathered. What can you tell us about the new evidence that supports this being a deliberate killing?
There was a bunch of people, witnesses, who were there when the killing happened. They were not included in interviews by the Israelis or any other investigators previously. There was also video evidence showing the area where the killing happened. Al Jazeera says that there's absolutely no way the Israeli soldier or soldiers did not see that Shireen and her colleagues were members of the press, given that they were wearing vests emblazoned with a big sign saying press.
And so what is different about this video? What can we actually see in it?
We can see that the way was clear from where the fire came that hit Shireen and her producer. There were no zigzags in the way. There was nothing hampering vision. Whoever fired at her could clearly see her.
I mean, that's compelling, but ultimately, won't you have to get inside the psychology of the IDF shooter? I mean, to that question, how can you actually know the Israeli soldier didn't just get nervous in a tense situation? Because deliberate motivation could be pretty hard to prove, right?
Jazeera's position is that there needs to be a thorough and transparent and independent investigation. That's precisely the point. The Israelis are required by Al Jazeera and other bodies to actually provide access to the soldier or soldiers who are accused of having fired on Shireen. So the investigators would be able to actually see clearly what happened at that particular moment.
Well, not only has Israel said no, but outgoing Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid said, quote, "No one will investigate IDF soldiers and no one will preach to us about morals in warfare, certainly not Al Jazeera," end quote. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, the press conference that Al Jazeera's lawyers held after the referral of the case to the ICC, one of the things that they said was that the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh was part of a larger campaign by the Israelis.
What campaign are you referring to?
The position of Al Jazeera is that the Israelis do not want the world to see what's going on under Israeli occupation, and therefore there's been a series of harassment of Al Jazeera's crews throughout the years. And the culmination of that harassment was the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh.
I think of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi and his killing at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and how the Post worked so hard to get justice for him. What similarities do you see between Khashoggi and Shireen Abu Akleh?
One similarity is the complex web of interests that the United States shares with both Saudi Arabia and Israel, regardless of whether the administration in place is a democratic administration or a Republican administration. Those interests always come into play. The conundrum that the Biden administration perhaps faces in this particular case is that from day one, it said that it was going to put a lot of emphasis on human rights internationally.
Abdurrahim, how well did you know Shireen Abu Akleh? And what occurs to you about the way she reported news, especially to her Palestinian audiences?
One of the things that have always arrested my attention about how she conducted herself is that, you know, she is obviously a very high-profile journalist. She was a leading female journalist when she joined the Al Jazeera. There were very few women in the Arab world as reporters. And yet, being in the office, she kept a very low profile. Hmm. The irony of the situation is that her killing, while she was on the job, has made her the story and has continued to make her the story for the last 6 months and will probably continue to make her a story, big story, for a long time to come.
Abdurrahim Fukara is the Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera. His organization has sent a formal complaint to the International Criminal Court to investigate the death of journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Abdurrahim, thank you very much.
Great to be with you, Marco, on a show that I love.
During these pandemic years, you've likely relied on one another to make it through, even when you're separated by walls or oceans. For an upcoming edition of The World, we're looking for stories about helpers, people who have made a difference in your life when times were tough. Send us a short voice memo with your story about someone who came through for you and how they made a difference in your life. Include your name and location and send us your voice memo in an email to myworld@theworld.org. We might feature your story on the show. Again, that's myworld@theworld.org. The Biden administration says it is expanding temporary legal status for Haitians already living in the United States. The move follows reports that some 60% of Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, is under the control of armed gangs. For more, we turn to Julia Gillette of the Migration Policy Institute. She knows the ins and outs of TPS, temporary protected status. Julia joins us from Washington. Let's start with the news, Julia. What does it mean to expand TPS for Haitians in the U.S.?
What it means is that about 110,000 Haitians are now newly eligible to apply for temporary protected status. TPS offers people protection from deportation and the ability to work legally in the United States. It's not a path to permanent status or citizenship, but it allows people to stay and be in the United States without fear of removal. Mm. TPS is now open to Haitians who have been in the United States for a month, since November 6th.
And what about Haitians who continue to arrive in the U.S.?
Those who have come since November 6th and those who arrive after today will not be eligible to apply for temporary protected status. TPS is always a program that's open to those already in the United States.
I mean, conditions in Haiti are awful right now, but they've been in a shambles at least since the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse in 2021. Why this decision now?
I suspect that it's because the conditions in Haiti have continued to deteriorate. There have been challenges, the assassination of the president, a major earthquake last year, but things have continued to get more and more difficult. Gangs have control of ports and, you know, many parts of the country. The UN says that there are catastrophic levels of hunger in Haiti. The Haitian government is so desperate, it's asking for foreign intervention to restore peace. This continues to get worse, and the United States and other countries have been hesitant to send forces. So I suspect that this is really a recognition of just how difficult things have become. Also, the government, you know, was at a decision point of extending TPS for those Haitians who were already part of the program. TPS had been open for those who entered the U.S. since July 2021. While they were making that decision, I think they also considered whether to reopen the program to new applicants and decided to do so.
If things get worse in Haiti, do you see this decision to expand a TPS as kind of a precursor to something larger?
It's possible. This current grant of TPS will extend through August 2024. So leading up to that date, there will be another decision point for the government of whether to extend TPS and also whether to open it to new applicants. If things look as bad in August 2024 as they do now, we may expect it to be opened again. You know, it's unclear. There could be an additional grant of TPS in the meantime, but, you know, certainly not guaranteed.
The Trump administration tried to cut back on TPS protections for those already in the United States. Biden is expanding TPS, in this case for Haitians. What legal authority does the White House have to do this?
Yeah, the executive branch has quite a lot of authority to grant temporary protected status to countries that are experiencing some kind of natural disaster or some extraordinary and temporary situation that makes it, you know, difficult to live there and makes the U.S. government not want to return people there. The Biden administration has made broad use of this program. It's opened TPS to an additional over 600,000 people since taking office. So that is a power that the Biden administration seems to have embraced.
Mm, and not just Haitians?
This current announcement is just about Haiti, but the Biden administration has also opened temporary protected status for people from Afghanistan, Cameroon, Ethiopia, Ukraine, and Venezuela. So it really has embraced its authority to open TPS to new countries.
Julia Gillette is a senior policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute, filling us in on a decision by the Biden White House to expand temporary legal status for Haitians already living in the United States. Julia, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Sometimes in international soccer, there's more at stake than just a final score. Take today's World Cup match between Spain and its former colony, Morocco. Yeah, sure, it was a great game on the field, but the backstory, that is centuries old. Today, Moroccans make up Spain's largest minority, about 17% of the population. Many are diehard soccer fans, and in Spain today, they turned out by the hundreds of thousands to watch Spain versus Morocco in post-colonial competition. Jerry Haddon was with Morocco's fans in Barcelona.
For a do-or-die day of soccer, the mood in Barcelona's Raval district was eerily calm pregame. That's especially weird because, well, this is Spain where soccer rules, and lots of Moroccans live in the Raval. A Moroccan man passes by the main plaza with his 7-year-old son, Adam. He's speaking in Arabic, but I catch him mentioning names of players.
¿Con quién vas hoy?
Marruecos.
I ask Adam who he's rooting for, and he tells me Morocco in Spanish. His dad doesn't want to chat, but he does tell me they'll be watching the match from the safety of their apartment. The dad was surely referring to the rioting in Brussels last week when Morocco beat Belgium. Hundreds of fans trashed cars and storefronts as they celebrated their upset win. A group of teenage girls comes running past. One, who would only give her first name, Amal, is draped in a Moroccan flag. Like Adam, she also speaks Spanish. In fact, she says she was born here, but she says she'd never cheer for Spain. Because of the racism here, she says. From the youngest age, Spanish society marginalizes you, makes you feel different. They call us Moro, she says. That's a reference to 8 centuries of Moorish rule of Iberia ending in 1492. In the 20th century, part of Morocco was a Spanish colony. They share a contentious and sometimes dangerous border where African migrants try to get into Europe. So today's game was tense on many levels. It was also hard-fought, with both teams missing clear opportunities. At a bar called the Rincón de Raval here in Barcelona, Moroccans cheered on their side. Yahya Rerdas, a 27-year-old tire factory worker, says he's been in Spain since he was 2 years old. Even though I grew up here, he says, we have our Moroccan culture, our language. This is historic. It's been 28 years since we made it to the quarterfinals, he says, but we're sure to make a goal and win. They don't, at least not in regular time, not in overtime, but neither does Spain. But in the penalty shootout, Morocco goalie Yassine Bono stops every shot against him. He stopped a bunch in regular play, too. Morocco clinches the win. The place goes wild. Yahya Rerdas is in tears. This is the greatest day, he says. It's been a long time since we've lived something like this. For our country, it's just incredible. Spaniards have been left feeling incredulous. They were the favorites. Their team usually dominates Morocco. Today, the tables turned. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
Amazing. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. Back tomorrow.